All right. Hello, everybody. Welcome. We are live from the Return of the Ring in Loughborough, England. And I am joined here this evening by a distinguished panel of people. That is the Mythgard students and faculty who are here at the Return of the Ring with me. Thanks, everybody, for joining us on sort of typically short notice. So I appreciate you guys who have been able to join us. So we're basically just, you know, we'd like to just sort of talk about the stuff that we have seen and heard already. We're only, gosh, a little less than halfway through the conference actually. But we've had a pretty full day today, and most everybody presented papers here this morning. We had four presenters present papers during the postgraduate symposium, which was a sort of a three-panel session of papers by graduate students. So. That was pretty. I got to be a respondent on that one and listen to many of them, though I was scheduled away from most of you guys' papers. I didn't actually hear your papers.
Yeah, right, you know.
So for those of you who are with us live, what we were going to do is just sort of talk a little bit about the stuff we've been doing here and the stuff that we've heard. We've had some pretty cool events so far. Talk about the stuff that we're looking forward to doing, and then we can definitely have some sort of open Q&A and stuff. Anything anybody wants to talk about, any questions that you guys who have joined us here in the NetMoot would like to ask, we can definitely do that too. So to start off, as I said, today we had the postgraduate symposium. I thought there were actually a lot of really good papers.
Brilliant papers. No. Excellent papers. Really good.
And it was, you know, one thing that we were talking about earlier was something that I was really impressed by, but, you know, it's something that I've really seen before in Tolkien studies in general. And one thing that I think is really encouraging for, you know, anyone else who's listening, who is thinking about getting into the world of Tolkien academia. It's such a supportive environment. Mm. I mean, yes. I really thought that was remarkable, the paper sessions this morning. You know, you didn't get anybody, you know, sniping and trying to tear people down. That occasionally happens at scholarly conferences. You get some people who are really competitive, some people who really like to listen to themselves talk. And, what, at an academic conference? but anyway, it was...
Sharks out there.
Yeah. I thought it was very supportive, very nurturing, and I was very, very impressed. And actually, I sat there and took out tons of notes from the other papers. There's some amazing research that was done.
Yeah.
And very encouraging, and I think in today's world for the up-and-coming young Tolkien academics, mm-hmm. that incredible supportiveness is so important and just makes you want to work even harder.
I agree. I think one of the things that I really like is seeing the breadth of scholarship that's going on in Tolkien studies right now. And it's not just, oh, we're looking down this path or we're only looking down this path. If you look at the range of papers that were on offer today, it was huge. And that's fantastic, because that's what we want more of. We want that kind of breadth of scholarship. And that's something to really look forward to, I think, in the next few years, because, again, looking around today, there's a lot of young people.
Yeah.
And that's fantastic.
I think just even the whole idea of having those panels, you know, having six panels of papers from, you know, people who are currently coming up doing graduate work, and, you know, basically the sort of, you know, the next generation of Tolkien scholars, that was really cool.
Mm-hmm.
And to see... You know, to see what's coming and to see, you know, because often, you know, there has been a little bit of like the same familiar faces. You know, you go to Kalamazoo and do the Tolkien at Kalamazoo, mm-hmm. Not that I don't love seeing them,
but it is nice to see new people coming through, because eventually that. Can we call them the old guard,
right.
if you want to? They're going to move on or off and
Done.
Shuffle off that
yeah.
mortal coil, etc. There needs to be people coming in behind them.
Yeah,
there needs to be. And that's what's great about today is seeing that number of people who are prepared to, you know, pick up that gauntlet, if you like. Yeah.
And very international as well.
Yes.
I mean, a huge amount of it. There was Finnish and there was
Polish.
Yeah. There was mm-hmm. all over the place.
And the breadth. I mean, there's a wonderful paper about the use of the border, the Finnish translations of the Board of the Rings.
Yeah,
that was
really cool. Looking at the translation of the Lord of the Rings into Finnish, and then the parody of the Lord of the Rings in Board of the Rings, and then the translation of the parody into Finnish, and comparing those together. That was
Yeah. Incredible.
Mm-hmm. Even knowing nothing about Finnish, that was really
yeah.
cool.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And it certainly was enough to convince me that the Finnish translation of Board of the Rings must be much funnier than the English version.
Because that wasn't funny at all.
No.
Of course they are. Exactly. It's not really setting a high bar there. Uh-huh. But yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So what we had was papers running from... there was one person who I heard talking who was doing a really close reading of the language of The Hobbit, looking at what that said about the dragon in particular. And the range went from that to talking about real person slash fan fiction.
Mm.
So completely different papers all the way through. And that's good as well. I really like the fact that there's so many different things being studied.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let me interrupt the flow for a second because I've realized that with terrible remissness, I haven't introduced people.
Oh.
And I should introduce you. I, by the way, for those of you who are here live, I had suggested that we do a video feed too, but I was voted down on that one. Because some people here don't want their parents to know that they're drinking. So, so let me introduce people. We have Andy Higgins here, and Sarah Brown, and we have Lexi Height, and Penny Holdaway, and Sandra Hall, and Isaac Juan Thomas, who have all joined us. These are all people who have been taking courses at Mythgard here together, and Sarah has been one of our preceptors this past semester. So we have that and our presence here at the conference in common. We've been enjoying getting to actually meet each other. This is one of a couple recent Mythgard gatherings at scholarly conferences that have been going on. There was a largish one at MythCon a couple weeks ago that I think, Penny, you're the only common denominator between
them.
You were both.
I am.
Yeah.
Yes, yeah. I was at both.
Yeah, that's
God moot.
Can I say how brilliant it is to actually see the Mythgard interface from this side of the table?
Seeing the magic.
Yes.
So question box is brilliant.
As I've been carrying around the Mythgard Institute all day, and have finally set it up here. And now we're currently broadcasting. It's not quite as exciting when we did our MythCon broadcast last summer. We were in a bar with dance music going on. We did manage to find a slightly quieter place that we're right next to the bar.
Wait until the Kaylee starts.
Waiting
for
the
Kaylee. Oh yes,
yeah,
right,
yeah,
exactly. Apparently, there's a
hootenanny.
A hootenanny going on. Yes, that is. Sarah has translated Kaylee for me because I had no idea what that was, and she told me it was a hootenanny.
Yeah.
And so now I have no further questions. Perfectly clear on what is going to transpire now.
And
so.
Professor Olson is going to hoot his nanny anytime.
So no video feed, as I say. So anyway, but of course now to make up for my remissness, I had to interrupt the flow of our conversation about the postgraduate symposium. So, but now there were I was very impressed by the breadth, and as you said, the scope that this conference has been very remarkable in general, of course,
mm-hmm.
for the number of people from many different countries around the world. It's been really fun, really exciting to meet people. It's so it's really easy, being in Britain and being in America to sort of think about. Tolkien as a
our possession.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes.
Yeah. It's something that belongs to us. Of course, less us than you, really.
Well,
honestly.
Yes, it belongs to me, actually.
Right. You personally.
Yes, yes. It's all mine.
But it's also been brilliant. It's also been brilliant to mix that and also see people like Tom Shippey and mm-hmm. Erlen Flieger, who are both taught in Mythgard Institute classes as well.
Yes.
And we just heard an incredible talk by Tom Shippey on leadership,
yes.
which was just, inspirational.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And very,
ways.
Very funny.
Yeah.
And funny.
Very, very
yes.
funny
yeah.
indeed.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, no, Tom is always so funny. And his talk was on leadership in the Lord of the Rings specifically, looking at sort of, and this was, he was explaining sort of inspired by two different things. One was this doctoral dissertation that was written by a Finnish
yeah.
business studies guy who was using Tolkien and writing on different sort of management the great line, of course, that he was delivering from the synopsis of the dissertation, was that, you know, he had categorized the people into different styles of leadership, and then there were sort of two, what are they called, the people who specialized in project work? Which were Aragorn and Frodo. So he had come across that, which he said he found kind of odd and had never really thought about it in that way before. And then he sort of told the story about having to, getting sort of cornered into giving this talk on the military virtues to a group of U.S. Army officers in St. Louis. And he didn't really explain exactly how that transpired, but anyway, he was. And so sort of thinking about military virtues in Tolkien and leadership, he sort of, that kind of led him to the things he was talking about today. It was really neat to hear him break down, some of the individual characters and the different styles and sort of pluses and minuses that they have as leaders specifically. There were a number of very interesting things there. One of the big picture things that I thought was really cool was how he was looking at what appears to be an evolution in Tolkien's thought over time about this, looking at The Hobbit and how there's really an absence of strong leaders in The Hobbit. Bilbo's not really a leader, even though, you know, he's sort of the leader of their expedition, but he's not really leading. Mm-hmm. Thorin is the leader, but he's a quite bad one on almost all occasions. And then you've got Gandalf, who appears to be the leader and then abandons them. So, The Hobbit has very few role models. The Silmarillion, even, he was going through, so at first, when he first said that, it's like, well, there's very little in the Silmarillion. My first knee-jerk reaction was, what are you talking about? But then, the more I was thinking about it, I was like, there aren't that many, for leadership, they're heroes.
Yes.
And
that was, of course, one of the good leaders. Very rarely good leaders.
I was going to suggest Tuor, actually, but then I thought he's probably, because he does lead.
Yes.
Even though it's on the, Olmo makes him, but he is more of a hero than a leader in a way.
Well, I wanted him to look at Iluvatar, actually. Except he said that you have to have the leader being present, and I thought,
He scores low on that scale.
But it was just the interaction, you could sort of like say that the interaction that he actually has with the Aino may be a version of leadership, which it is a version of leadership,
You actually came up with a good suggestion that he hadn't come up with, and that was Haleth.
Oh, yes, Haleth.
Yes.
Haleth is a good leader.
That's a good one.
Yes. She's a good leader. Now, necessarily always a wise leader. I mean, there's, some of the things she does, at least, her people dislike, but she's a strong leader.
Yes.
Right? She gets
they follow her.
Yeah.
And they need to.
Yeah. Talk about someone who really has followers. And that, both the strength that she shows and her response to Caranthir. I love that. It's one of my favorite lines from the Silmarillion. Where are Haldir, my brother, and Haldad, my brother? If you fear an alliance between Haleth and those who slaughtered her kin, then the ways of the Eldar are strange to men, and then she turns away from them and leads them across on the march. That was, she doesn't get much screen time, so we don't see too much of her. But there's certainly, lots of bad, there's certainly some bad leaders. Mm-hmm. Not only people like, Turin, of course, which certainly
follow at your peril.
Yes, yeah. I wouldn't want to follow Turin, though almost everyone did. Mm-hmm. I mean, think of the number of people who refused, who were basically able to withstand Turin's leadership.
Yeah.
I mean, Gwyndor.
Yeah, he generated a lot of loyalty, and that was another thing that Tom brought up, was this issue of loyalty.
Charisma, do you think? I mean, maybe... Yeah.
He certainly did have it.
He must have had it, because he did seem to, despite his faults, followed him.
Well, and one of those facts that I always find easy to forget about Turin, that he does mention at one point that Turin is the most devastatingly gorgeous human man ever in the history of Middle-earth. And that, that's not that it's only in a pretty face, but clearly that seems to be part of that overall picture of his charisma.
People did
fall in various kinds of love with him wherever he went. So he did inspire, and you think about his leadership among the outlaws, there are moments when you can see him sort of threatening to become a real leader, but then he always, you know, as in every other aspect of his career, is always then promptly shooting himself in the foot and doing something disastrous.
Another point Tom made about the visible leader was very interesting, too, the fact that a leader has to be visible, and that if you look at the difference between a Theoden and a Denethor, you know, there's a great example where Denethor, you know, locks himself up in a tower somewhere, and the whole thing goes to hell, and Theoden, of course, is out there riding, and, you know,
versus suicidal.
Some generals have to die, exactly.
And, but they're in isolation, aren't they? Well, Theoden was in the front.
Yes. The sacrificial leader is in isolation.
Yeah, which, of course, might be Sauron's working to keep, you know, that's what he does to Denethor anyway. Maybe he's keeping him in that tower.
Right, and then of course you have even in the scene where with Pippin and Denethor, where, you know, Denethor emphasizes how Sauron leads from the back. You know that he is himself not he is an overlord, but not a leader. It was a very cool talk. But then anyway, so I was sort of talking originally about the kind of chronology of it. So again, Hobbit, very few leaders. The Silmarillion. Some, but really not. Of course, also my first thought, I'm going to digress again. In the Silmarillion, the first thing that crossed my mind when he said there were no strong leaders in the Silmarillion, I immediately was like channeling Jordan Brown from the Silmarillion seminar, and I'm like, Fingolfin, come on, Fingolfin was a good leader. But then, of course, he went on to dismantle that, you know, that basically, really the choice to go across the Hel-Caraxa was stubborn to the point of stupidity. Turn around and go home. It's actually, that would have been the move right there. turn around and go out back and ask for forgiveness. They gave it to Finarfin. They'll probably give it to you. And I agree. I mean, really, when you look at it, it's kind of a dubious choice that Fingolfin makes. And of course, the greatest act of Fingolfin, is kind of in the suicidal camp, of course, when he goes and challenges Morgoth, and that's certainly not a leadership thing. It's a you know, a heroic act. But that's actually kind of I think an interesting kind of contrast. Thinking of course, Denethor was his illustration of the suicidal, you know, leader, but you know, Fingolfin does that. I mean, Fingolfin. He challenges Morgoth, but not really with any belief he's not deluded into thinking he's going to take him one-on-one. It's despair that leads him to do what he does. Now, his despair manifests itself in a very different way than Denethor's does. I mean, I think we can see some real contrasts there.
I wonder if that's an example of that heart should be harder Battle of Maldon type thing. You know, he knows he's not going to conquer Morgoth, but he goes up against him because, you know.
Yeah, and at least, and doesn't, in that sense, there's something, it's like he's a cross between the self-sacrificial and the suicidal, right? He's suicidal, but it's just him. He doesn't take his whole army with him to go into a despairing, desperate, no-hope battle.
Yes, interesting.
Do you think he becomes a kind of martyr and thus sort of encourages his troop? Because that was the big thing about the sacrificial leader compared to the suicidal leader. The sacrificial leader's death means something. It raises the morale of the troops, even though the leader dies.
Yeah.
Whereas the suicidal guy, he doesn't. He just sort of stays behind the lines and kills himself in despair.
But isn't Tolkien saying something about that? I mean, it's Gandalf who says it, isn't it? That despair is for those who see the end.
Beyond all.
So I think, actually, that's right. Tolkien's actually making that point, isn't he? That despair is not a good choice.
But I wouldn't have thought that Fingolfin was a sacrificial one, in the sense that Theoden went out to achieve an end that was greater. Whereas I thought Fingolfin was just purely emotion.
He was so cheesed off,
I've got to go out there and do something. And it was just emotion taking over. Whereas Theoden was a definite decision. I'm not going to survive this, but they need our help. Exactly. And we're going to provide that help. And if we die in the attempt, so be it. But that's what we are doing. And I think it's a slightly, it's a different motivation and a different approach.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, in Theoden certainly was, I mean, I think there's a big difference between, you know, riding out in defiance of death, knowing that you're quite likely to die, but going anyway, mm-hmm. and actually seeking death, which Gandolfin clearly was seeking death. I mean, I think that's kind of hard to argue against, that he was, that he knew full well he was going to die. But the idea of martyrdom is interesting, though, because it's, I'm not sure, it's not obvious to me that Fingolfin is thinking that. I agree with Sandra that it seems to be a much more spontaneous and driven by emotion and driven by despair thing. But the effect of it, when the effect of that story on others does, in fact, seem to be at least somewhat like the effect of that a martyr can have. Mm. The fact that Morgoth is wounded. You know, okay, yeah, Fingolfin was killed, but he, you know, Morgoth is limping now.
Yeah. Yeah. Shows he's vulnerable.
He's striking a blow for hope in a way. Yeah. He's saying, I'm not going to do it, but this shows you can do it, and the next guy who comes
and
might
of course,
have a shot.
The next guy who comes is Luthien.
Is Luthien, yeah. Oh, that was the next girl. Sorry. Right.
Yes. Well, no, but yeah, if you think about it, the way in which Beren and Luthien's story is explicitly taken as a cause for hope amongst, you know, everybody else. You know, that's, of course, what leads, well, okay, leads Maedhros to propose the what turns into the Nirnaeth Arnoediad, so maybe bad example. But anyway, but the point is, it does encourage people. Mm. But I think that you can see even the attempt of Beren and Luthien is not 100% hopeless because of Fingolfin's example. Like, okay, you know, he is not invulnerable. It's not 100% hopeless. It's only like 98% hopeless.
Yes. Yeah.
And but that's something. You know, that's a significant 2%. So I do think, but I would almost put that into the category, certainly again, not of a sort of an aspect of Fingolfin's leadership, but another example in Tolkien where something which is bad has a good outcome, you know, where good comes of even tragic things and even you know, really bad decisions. I'll now cease digressing a second time. No leaders in The Hobbit. Very, you know, a few, but, you know, relatively few examples of good leadership in the Silmarillion. And then in The Lord of the Rings, you know, Shippey is arguing that you see Tolkien begin to more consciously contemplate this. And in particular, you know, the sort of the kernel of his Lord of the Rings argument was what he argues, and I think that is a fairly solid argument, that Denethor and Theoden are really put forward as, you know, the two figures in this deliberate contrast with each other. And one of the things which is so, especially with the way in which the self-sacrificial and the suicidal leader kind of reflect each other, you know, really, really invites the comparison between the two of them.
He say about Faramir? He said Faramir wasn't.
This was in a moment where he was also talking about the film Faramir too.
Yes, that's right. Know, he kept bringing in the film. Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, because he did discuss both separately, the film version and the. But yeah, this is where he said with the film Faramir that, like, you know, you wouldn't put him in charge of a sandwich.
Of a sandwich.
And clearly, yeah, in the, and of course the thing and the one criticism that he did give, and this I thought was because Faramir, if there's anybody in the Lord of the Rings who screams leadership material, it's Faramir, even more than Aragorn, frankly. Mm. I mean, Faramir there's even that moment where, again, we see this kind of thing with Aragorn. You know, we see people, the relationship that Frodo begins to develop with him even on the way to Bree, or to Rivendell from Bree. But, you know, there's that moment when Pippin sees Faramir riding in and understands, like, this is a man that people would die for, and he starts, like, gets swept up and starts crying out, Faramir, I've never met you, but I'm already
you
a
look
fanboy.
Like a leader.
Yeah. Right, exactly. I mean, that's, you know, and Barragán bolting off the...
How did I get the screen in?
downstairs. Baragon, you know, bolting off the wall to go running out. That's definitely. I mean, again, you know, his the not just charisma, but the leadership of Faramir is so powerfully emphasized.
But Tom shot that down in flames, didn't he?
He did.
He said that Faramir actually makes some leadership decisions that are poor decisions. It's out of loyalty and misplaced loyalty that sometimes a good leader needs to say no.
Yeah.
That I'm not going to follow that order. That is a wrong order. I'm not going to do that. I'm going to resign my commission.
Yeah.
That's why he wouldn't accept Faramir as being a particularly good leader.
That he shouldn't have actually tried to keep Osgiliath.
That's right. Because that was a crazy order from a crazy guy, and he should have said, that's crazy.
Yeah.
And yet he just says, right, okay, off I go.
Yeah. The difference between physical courage and moral courage.
Yes.
That's what he was saying.
Yeah.
Yes.
Exactly. Yep. Yeah. The moral courage to stand up to your commander and say, you know, no, that is a crazy order. But the thing also there, and this is where, you know, as much as I sympathize and as much as I powerfully shared the outrage of so many Tolkien fans at the depiction of Faramir in the films, and like the general wussification of Faramir in the Peter Jackson films, the one thing I will defend about it that they got right. The daddy issues they really brought out. I thought they did a great job of bringing the Boromir issues, but which all comes back to the daddy issues. It's not even just blind loyalty to his military superior. It's the daddy thing.
He's trying to show daddy.
Faramir's, you know, if I should return, father, think better of me. It's like, that's what's at issue right there. He's going. He's obeying this crazy order because.
He wants daddy to love him.
He wants
trying
daddy
to show
to love
daddy.
Him.
Yeah, he's trying. Yeah, exactly.
It really is. It's a very childlike. That is such a touchingly, not just childlike, childish moment by Faramir. And I guess, you know, they emphasized it so much more in the film than Tolkien is much more understated with that, but. They were dead right about that. I mean, that's a big part of what's going on with
Faramir. I've always thought it's interesting, too, that, you know, Tolkien gives Faramir the dream of the wave.
Yes.
Always thought isn't it interesting that Faramir has daddy issues? And, of course, when we think of Tolkien, you know, his father died when he was very young. And there's some interesting things that you might do there with that comparison.
Yeah, I agree.
That's your next paper, then, Andy.
There you go. That's my next.
Okay.
I'll work on that tonight in the hotel room. Exactly.
Speaking of daddy issues, Vanarin says that Thingol is a good example of a bad leader who does not listen to his good advisor, namely his wife, of course.
Yeah.
And Théoden is an example of a good leader who listens to his bad advisor, which is, you know, of course, he breaks out of that.
Yeah.
Thingol, not so much.
Well, Tom Shupey did mention Thingol as being a bad leader, didn't he?
Yes. He was one of his first examples of. And Fëanor, of course, who's an extremely effective leader, but disastrously so.
And well before after his mother died, but well before all of the problems in Valinor.
Yes.
He was exhibiting all of that type of. Jealous leadership, and one of Tolkien's very later writings, essays, was the, see if I can say this right, Shibboleth of Fëanor, which was, this is how his mother spoke, and therefore we're going to speak like this, and anybody who doesn't speak like this is against us, and then you sort of like started getting the camps, and that was well before Melkor had got involved.
Right.
So Fëanor has obviously had leadership issues right from the very start, really.
Yes, and daddy issues there too.
Yeah.
See, there is a paper in that.
There we go. Yeah. It's just building.
Yeah.
Taking notes.
Yes, very good. So that was the thing which has happened most recently. Well, other than dinner in the bar, that's the most recent thing that's happened.
Dinner is very good.
Very good.
I've just got to, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I've got to mention the Ugluk leadership theory, which Sansu also held dear to his heart, which if you don't do what I say, I remove the first two heads of the nearest soldiers. Next.
Yes. Shippy said he wanted a degree from the Ugluk School of Business Management.
That was the one he approved of. Yeah. Yes. 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 You could do that
it
at
worked.
Times.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
I used to call Shippy the Gandalf of Tolkien studies. Now I'm going to call him the Ugluk of Tolkien
studies. I think he'd appreciate that more.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes, I love how Shippy in the program for The Return of the Ring has identified himself as a Tolkien polemicist. That's his title that he's giving himself. Very good. I'm glad you remembered the Ugluk thing. That was, it's the pinnacle of leadership.
Yeah.
But of course, one of the other very exciting events from today was the One Man Lord of the Rings.
Oh, fantastic.
Which was fantastic. I don't know if people listening have not gotten a chance to see this, if there's ever a performance anywhere near you, it is fantastic. Now, of course, the performance is, as you probably know, I mean, it's a performance of the films, not the book. So basically, you know, what he does is an abbreviated performance of all three films, from one end to the next. He is so incredibly talented.
Yes.
I mean, I can't remember hearing someone who does impressions and sounds better than he does. I mean, the voices were perfect.
They were so good.
Ian McKellen, Elijah Wood, Sean Astin,
Gollum.
Andy Serkis's Gollum. He nailed Andy Serkis's Gollum. And Christopher Lee. He did Christopher Lee.
And Legolas's hair. Was just fantastic.
Yes, he has several running jokes which were very funny. The Legolas's hair one was, the first time it comes up is in the Council of Elrond when he does Aragorn saying, "You have my sword," it's just, "and my hair."
And my beard.
Because I broke my stupid axe.
Aragorn sounded a bit Tony Blair to me, though. That was my which, again, leader,
sure. But at the same time as doing all these voices, he had all the music.
Yes.
And the sound effects.
And that skull wing was absolutely fantastic.
And the marching armies and the Ents and everything.
He did the Uruk-hai army marching up from the distance to Helm's Deep was incredible.
So effective.
It was amazing, and probably the single thing I was most impressed by was he got the horns exactly, like you could tell the difference between the horns of the Rohirrim and the horns of the orcs and the horns of, horn at Helm's Deep. Boromir's horn. They were perfect.
Yes.
I was astounded. I was astounded at the quality of his sound effects.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was a remarkable show.
But I think some of the funny stuff, I mean, a lot of it was very, very funny. But he also makes kind of intertextual references.
Yes.
Mm. So you have a moment where he is Elrond, and he becomes Elrond so perfectly, the eyebrows suddenly shape themselves into Elrond. And then he just looks at the audience and says, "Mr. Anderson." That's it. The audience falls apart.
I think my favorite line is when he goes, when he's talking about orcs being created, and he goes, "How are the orcs created?" And he goes, "Read the Silmarillion."
Absolutely perfect. When did he reference Johnny Cash?
Wheel of Fire.
I just can't imagine anybody going to see him, though, that's not seen the films.
You'd struggle.
You'd really struggle to actually understand the references. I mean, I think you would have had to have seen the films.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, because, as you said, he's doing the films, he's not doing the books.
No.
I mean, it was so perfect, even down to the hand gestures and body posture of the different characters, and he would signal which are so clear if you've seen the films, the Ian McKellen Gandalf holding his staff gesture with the way that he does his arms, and probably my favorite moment, I mean, there are many points that were very funny that I really enjoyed, but the fact that when he did the "you shall not pass" speech. Mm. He did the whole "you shall not pass" speech. Yeah. And I was like, okay, even in the context of a one-man show, which is largely a parody of the film version, that speech will still give me chills.
That was very good.
And he said afterwards that he actually did it, and Ian McKellen was in the audience one night and actually loved it and everything. And just imagine doing that in front of Ian McKellen must have been quite
interesting.
No pressure. No, not at all.
And then he talked to him for an hour afterwards, didn't he?
And Ian McKellen revealed the secret of the Balrog, which was quite interesting.
Yeah,
we'll keep secret.
So the guy's name's Charlie Ross.
Charlie Ross, thank you.
Yes.
So if you get to see him, he's really with it.
Definitely.
He actually did the show here, and then he was flying right back up to Edinburgh to do another show tonight. Mm-hmm. So.
And he'd just flown in as well. It was definitely a flying visit, that one, wasn't it?
I think part of what astonished me was that he did all three films of The Lord of the Rings in a space that was about 2 foot by 3 foot.
Yes, it was tiny. He was cramped into this tiny little carpeted space, and it was not even on a stage. He was at the bottom of a lecture hall, basically at the end of the small, a little section next to the desk. Between two cramped light stands. And he just kept running around in little tight circles.
Walls.
Oh, when he said it was like a Warner Brothers cartoon. He slapped against the wall. It was so funny.
Yeah.
There were moments where I was actually crying with laughter and I was holding onto my stomach. It hurt so much. It was so funny. And there was one bad moment where I'd just taken a drink out of my water bottle and I actually did end up having water coming out of my nose.
Oh, no.
It's just awful. I just about managed not to spit over the person in front of me.
But there were some really moving moments, too. Yeah. You know, the death of Boromir, the way he did that was incredible.
Yes.
No, I was really impressed by that. I mean, I was telling Sarah after the show, had I been writing something like that, I would have not been able to hold back. Like the comparative rareness of the times that he made jokes. Like most of it was done. It was intrinsically funny because of what he was doing, going back and forth from one character to the other. But he, you know, so many of the scenes, I kept expecting a joke because I would have been tempted to put one in there, but he didn't. You know, and he did it straight. And that was actually, I thought that was really, of course, it made his jokes funnier when they happened. But it also allowed for a really interesting mixture of genuine pathos mixed in with what was a genuinely funny show, but and really sensitive, I thought, about what aspects of the films he chose to make fun of or to have fun with, perhaps I should say.
Yes, because he wasn't mocking it.
No, not at all.
No, he was having fun with it. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And he appreciated actually having us as an audience who actually knew what he was getting at and actually got his jokes.
Oh, I think he really played to his audience today.
Like especially that moment when Elrond reveals that Arwen is tied to the fate of the ring. And he says,
what?
Or when the elves turn up at Helm's Deep and we get another why moment. Contractual obligations. And there are little scenes, of course, that you really remember, like Denethor and the cherry tomatoes.
And that
became a bit of a running gag for a few minutes, didn't it?
All the way to the end.
As a burning Denethor is flying on the end of the tower, he's still chewing on a cherry tomato.
And the way he did the sort of the escalation of Denethor's eating scene with like increasingly repulsed expression on Pippin's face as he's trying to sing his song.
He also did some ad-libbing, like when that person came in late, and he completely played that up.
Oh, yes.
Because he walked over in character and said, "Are you running away like an elf?"
Well, he thought they were elves, I thought, because they were in costume.
One was in costume,
The elf just ran away.
But he stayed in character the whole time, which it didn't break anything. He was just, and he kept going with it. It was just great. And then he did a lot with our audience participation. When we reacted, he kind of played it up, which made it even better.
There were definitely moments where he was playing up to the audience.
It just made it better. And he knew they were Dolmen scholars, so he was all about playing it up. Like the crying Sam. He does the eyes, and then he did under the nose. Like, and then Frodo with the wine.
And I loved at the end when he said, okay, this is the optional ending number 2.
No, he's an absolute star.
I wonder if he'll do The Hobbit at some point.
That would be good. Well, he's going to have three films to play with, isn't
he? Yes, absolutely.
His performance for
Tomb of the Nazgul. We'll see that. Sorry, I'm fixated.
How is he going to do Radagast and the Bunny Sled?
Oh, yeah.
That'll be interesting.
Then again, how is Peter Jackson going to do Radagast and the Bunny Sled? Never mind. Let us leave the Bunny Sled to one side.
Just for now.
Change
the disc.
Yes.
Yeah, that was good. Change the DVD.
Second movie.
I hope you're keeping up. And then I thought the other really interesting seminar yesterday was the one on source criticism we had Verlin Flieger and it was a really interesting discussion about the idea of how one uses source criticism with Tolkien, and that idea of, you know, the kind of the parlor game of trying to match the different sources or to kind of see what Tolkien did with the sources. I thought was fascinating, and something, of course, that you, Professor Olson, have been teaching us all.
Well, and that's, you know, one of the things that I thought was really one of my favorite remarks that was made, and I wish I could remember who made it, but I don't, was basically sort of thinking about source criticism, that is, finding the sources and analogs that seem to fit with the text and reading them and studying them as a way of kind of crossing a cultural gap, to sort of get closer to, not that it necessarily, you know, not that it's the secret key to reveal all meaning in Tolkien's works or something, or that you've like decoded it or whatever, but just to say, because I mean, I this was to me the thing which was most rewarding about the Tolkien and the Epic class last year, just reading the Kalevala and then reading the Children of Húrin afterwards. You know, you don't even have to do a point-by-point comparison but it helps so much. Everyone always finds it so strange, especially when you're new to the Silmarillion, when Turin's sword talks back to him at the end, like when all of a sudden the sword up and speaks, and it's such a jarring, strange moment for so many people. And I remember first reading that, and I was like, did I just read that right? I'm going to go back. Yeah. No, the sword is talking. Okay, all right.
Not quite as bad as the talking purse?
No, that was a little stranger, but at least it had a longer and less dramatic speech. But anyway, but after reading the Kalevala, and then you go back to it, it feels so different.
Yeah.
You know, and again, it's not that like, now I understand it, now, you know, the Kalevala is the key to, but it's, it helps you to begin to understand sort of some of the things that were kind of part of Tolkien's literary culture that helped to sort of inform that. It feels less alien, less foreign.
Gives you a different perspective on it.
Yeah.
You knew what you learn what he's writing out from, and what was around him as a child.
Yeah.
I think as somebody who read Andrew Lang and read a lot of the stuff that he did as a child, I didn't realise that aspect of it. To me, it doesn't seem so foreign because he isn't foreign to me. So it's coming out of my culture. And I thought that was a very telling comment, that there is this cultural gap. And I mean, nothing that was said in that particular seminar, but I did remember somebody not understanding at that time at the Buckland when the ponies are stabled at the other side of the field at Crick Hollow, and they go out and they get the ponies and they're going off towards the Old Forest, and somebody that lived in the Midwest in the America was saying, why would they walk such a distance? And they had no conception of the smaller
the
fields,
size of
and, field. And so pictures were sent to sort of like say this is what the English countryside looks like. Oh, right. But until that comment was made, I was thinking, well, why are they finding that difficult? It's just the other side of a field, and I think that's across a lot of things, isn't it? That something that seems maybe natural because you've read the same books. If you've not read those, you're wondering where Tolkien's coming from.
Yeah.
Even the word field conveys something very different.
Oh, right, okay.
If you're from, say, Texas.
Yes.
It does, you know, if you're from the East Midlands.
I think one of the important questions that came out of that particular talk was the question of why do we bother with source criticism? What is the purpose of source criticism? Why do we even worry about it? And I think it comes back to the point you were making a moment ago, that it's about gaining a new perspective. It's getting that slightly different flavour from the text, that just understanding a little bit about where Tolkien himself came from gives you just a new way of seeing his text. Mm. You don't have to, but it just does something else for you. It does something else for the reading, doesn't it?
And then you can build upon that by seeing what Tolkien did.
Yeah.
And the real art of what he did in terms of, did he fill in the gaps? Did he try to clean this up? Did he, you know, that's the real fun stuff too. Mm-hmm. Once you've got the sources down and everything.
Yeah, it's not about finding a book and saying, oh look, this is where Tolkien's stuff on this comes from. Here it is. It's right here. That's not what it was about, was it?
Yeah. No. And then it was interesting talking about the shadow that Tolkien casts moving forward, and this idea of, you know, the fact that when you read something after Tolkien, you know, immediately you think, well, this is Tolkien, you know, and just that what writers have to go through now, as Tom Shippey said, sometimes to write themselves out of Tolkien.
Yes.
And I remember reading I can't remember what author said, they said, when you're writing fantasy, usually your first book or your second book is very Tolkienian, mm-hmm. and then you start to move away from that, basically, and everything. So he does cast a very long shadow. Mm. Mm.
And even indirectly, you know, you think of the way in which Tolkien, not even just people, writers who love Tolkien and who are writing, who end up writing derivative Tolkien fantasy, but even so many of the basic assumptions that are inextricably tied to, I mean, one thing, for instance, that I would say, I would, and this seems like a radical thing, but I would suspect if it were not for Tolkien, the concepts of swords and sorcery would not be inextricably tied together. Mm. Why is fantasy medieval? Mm. Why, when you're writing fantasy, do you have people using swords?
Yeah, why don't they have Gatling guns?
Right, and magic. You know, so in some way, we have either technology or magic. And magic is almost always, I mean, like, it's not that nobody deviates from that, of course, but that is such a bedrock assumption that naturally when you're telling a fantasy story, it has to be in a medieval or quasi-medieval setting. Mm. Well, that's Tolkien. Mm.
Yes.
That's totally, you know, if had Tolkien not written, would that be true? I think that fantasy would still be happening. Mm. It would look very different, of course, and it might not be, I doubt it would have made the mainstream in the way that it has. But it would be being written, but I suspect that even that basic a thing, you know, and the way that that's, you know, a larger thing, but even sort of smaller things. I mean, you know, like the hobbits and the things that are told about hobbits, even the you know, from everything, like, you know, all of the films and gaming systems, you know, from Dungeons and Dragons on forwards and everything, like all of the basic assumptions about what a fantasy world looks like, how sort of the natures and characteristic of these different races. Even if you're not writing a derivative Tolkien plot, your dwarves are almost guaranteed to look like Tolkien's dwarves.
And elves.
Your elves especially.
I mean, when you think that Tolkien rescued the elves from the sort of like Victorian flower fairies.
Yes.
And he's the one that's done it. And you look at any of the elves now in the role-playing games or anything like that.
Yeah.
They're nothing
Tolkien's
like
elves.
Well, I mean, yes, they're Banff.
Yeah.
Right. Mm. I mean, the first edition, Dungeons & Dragons, so explicitly derivative
of
Tolkien.
Yes.
I mean, it's even down to, like, the race attributes and things. Yes. I mean, I was reminded of this. I was reminded of my distant high school Dungeons & Dragons playing days when I was reading in Unfinished Tales and the description of Turin in the version of the Narn that's in Unfinished Tales. Mm. And how it says, he was as agile as any elf, but stronger as men are. And I was immediately thinking, right, if you roll an elf, you get a +1 dexterity, whereas if you're a human, you have a bonus to strength. Straight
there
out of Tolkien.
Yeah.
Quantified, slapped down on the page. There it is.
Yeah.
You know, that's
40-sided dice or whatever it was, right?
Not 40.
God, you're taking me back now.
Oh, yeah.
Goodness
Long
me.
Weekends in the basement.
Nostalgia.
Oh, God, yeah.
But, I mean, but again, even, and the way that those things kind of have, you know, percolated out, you know, again, through gaming and through film and everything, it's just, you know, it's for anybody, for a fantasy writer to do something genuinely genuinely different. Again, even if they don't have the plot, that's the same. Is very rare, and not that that's itself like an intrinsic fabulous virtue. That's a sort of another thing. The only thing that annoys me more than totally derivative Tolkien fantasies is like deliberately anti-Tolkien. Like, what I'm writing has 0% in common with Tolkien. See, and it's like. But notice it's actually not very good either. So anyway, there are some that work really well, but there are very few. I mean, this is one of the things, as I said in class this past summer, in the modern fantasy class, that I really admire about Le Guin. Mm. Is, you know, the Earthsea was like a legitimately non-Tolkien derivative, but very imaginative, high-quality work of fantasy. But it's a short list, you know, of really excellent, top-notch fantasy constructions, which are as free from, you know, Tolkienian influence as Le Guin was. Mm-hmm. You know, not that everyone is shooting for that. You know, many of the other authors that we read this past semester, you know, have no. I mean, like Jim Butcher, for instance, with his multiple Tolkien references. You know, sort of explicitly doing that. You know,
or Terry Pratchett or someone like that.
Exactly. So, I mean, there's no reason that must be a goal for all modern fantasy writers. But anyway, yeah, that is certainly something that. Seeing Tolkien as a source for modern writers was definitely another interesting aspect of that discussion.
Mm-hmm. And also for modern media as well. When you think of the number of films or television series which are definitely based on Tolkien. I mean, the Star Wars films are very much Lord of the Rings, and Babylon 5 had Khazad-dûm as one of the places in it. I mean, you know, so obviously Stravinsky had read Lord of the Rings as well. So I think it's had a huge influence on sort of modern media, isn't it?
Well, that's why we're all here, isn't it? Mm. Because Tolkien has had such a massive influence on our lives. That's why I'm here. That reading the Lord of the Rings for the first time when I was six, seven, I think. I grabbed it off my dad's shelf. And I have just continually read that text ever since. Mm. It changed my life. There's no other reason why I would be here. And, you know, that's the influence that Tolkien has had. I mean, you're talking about on mass media, definitely on people who are writing their own literature, definitely. But just on ordinary Joannas like me, you know.
Well, and the other panel on higher education, too, is very interesting because the other thing that was discussed is that idea of, you know, Tolkien classes and how popular they are and how students want more of that and everything.
Mm-hmm. And so there are some lecturers are being reluctantly led in that direction because, unfortunately, economic reality is they actually have to provide classes.
Teach what people want.
They teach what people want.
Yeah.
Yes, yeah.
Well, there was a teacher from South Africa who started an elective on Tolkien, and he said that literally people started lining up before 6 o'clock in the morning to sign up for that class.
Because it was limited numbers and first come, first serve.
First come, first serve, you know.
And now he's got people doing their master's dissertations based on Tolkien from that elective class, you know. So that was a very interesting panel. I mean, somebody from South Africa and
Japan.
And
Wales, England, and then me from America.
Who was it who was put next to the admissions office?
That was me.
Oh, that was you.
My fairy and fantasy class was taught next to the admissions office. Yes.
That's right.
In fact, it was this big central room, and the admissions office was up on the third floor, but they have windows looking down into my classroom. So that was.
So you have people wandering by, you know.
Just next to the waiting room, where people would come in to wait for their tours and stuff. But again, you know, it, of course, one reason was simply just because it was a big class, of course. So that was, you know, but not too big. It wasn't so big that people would come in and be like, "Oh, look at the huge classes." But it was clearly a large and engaged class. So it is a reality, you know. And although many. You know, many academics, many faculty are still highly resistant to it. Certainly, the people who are thinking more and more, and with more and more urgency of late about the bottom line, are more and more in favor of Tolkien courses and of giving students
what they want.
Yes. It was also interesting, it's been medievalists that have brought it into academia and as you have done, Professor Olson. But then the fact that it's now moving away and it's actually broadening out, and it's different faculty members who are delivering courses on it and not just medievalists.
And did you notice today in the postgraduate symposium?
Mm.
How many medievalists were there? Very few. Were there any? I'm not trying to think of any of the students who gave papers who were actual medievalists. That was the thing that was really striking to me. But that's the most pronounced example I've seen of that. I've seen that trend, you know, more and more people. And this has been visible at Kalamazoo. Visible because they stand out, because you'll have like the few 20th century Brit people sort of walking around with guarded expressions amongst all the medievalists at Kalamazoo, because they're there to deliver Tolkien papers. And there have definitely been more of those of late, but that was, you know, unanimous or close to unanimous anyway today. And that was really fascinating. So, I mean, and I think it's a really good thing. I mean, obviously, I have nothing against medievalists doing Tolkien, but I think that it's definitely a, you know, if we would like to see Tolkien studies sort of take the next step, you know, into sort of more general acceptance as an academic field, it needs to go there because even people like Tom and Michael Drought and people like that. Always, I mean, again, even Tom would have a little asterisk next to his name among other 20th century Brit specialists. Mm-hmm. It was like, he's this Anglo-Saxonist. Mm. What the heck is he talking about, right? Who is this Anglo-Saxon guy, this Anglo-Saxon philologist, to tell me who is the author of the 20th century,
mm-hmm.
right?
You know, there still has always been that element of it.
That was such a deliberate thumbing of his nose.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. But, so again, I think it's cool that that we can see, sorry, it's probably Dave. Yes, it is. it's again, I think, for as far as like the more sort of widespread acceptance of the field, it needs to gain more traction in 20th century Brit studies, and so I think that's
but even wider than that, wasn't it? Professor Martin Baker at the end was saying that it should move out towards studying the readership. Now, what was the name of the discipline he was talking about?
Well, he was talking about the films and fandom and everything.
Mm? Yeah. Cultural sociology.
Reader response, so it was actually moving away from literature studies into a much wider remit, and he was saying that that's where we should be moving towards with the studies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the impact that fandom has had on, you know, the life of Tolkien in terms of fandom and movies and all that.
And everything. And why does it affect that reader and not that reader? It was very, very interesting, and a very, very international panel of students giving papers, really, weren't they? Mm-hmm. Which was very, very good.
Yeah, I found it interesting, the women from Japan talking about how the first translator of Lord of the Rings into Japanese was someone who wrote haiku poetry.
Yes. Yes.
And then they redid the translation, and the second person was different, and people were up in arms because the first translation was much more poetic and everything and stuff like that. You just want to read it in Japanese now and see the difference in your spare time.
Surely, Andrew, you have time to pick up Japanese.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I'll do that. Yeah, sometime tonight around 3.
After you've written the paper on...
After I've written the paper. I read the 5 books in my bag and worked on my PhD.
Only
and
5.
Then I'll do that.
Yeah. Only 5
only
books.
Only five. Day 2.
You were the only one that put your hand up when you were asked if anybody knew any Finnish.
Any Finnish.
And
right.
you would put your hand up.
And then I said plotting, like Tolkien.
I think one of the important things that came out of that end session today was the agreement that we need to stop being apologetic about studying Tolkien. We've gone way past that now. And the more apologetic we are, the more we remind people that there's something to be apologetic about. So we need to stop that. And I think now we have got into that phase of Tolkien studies now, where people are just no longer saying, yes, yes, I'm really, really sorry, but actually this is about Tolkien, but, you know, forgive me for that. We don't do that anymore, and that is really good. I think I described it as third wave Tolkien studies. But I think that's the marvellous thing that I've seen, and I've seen that even myself over the last, what, 10 years maybe, is we've got to that stage now where it's, yeah, actually, sod you, we're doing Tolkien studies, deal with it.
Yeah, you don't, it doesn't need a defence. I mean, it's, you know, of course, and it's not to say that there aren't still the people out there.
Oh, there's still a lot of resistance. Yeah, we're just ignoring them better now.
Yes. Yeah.
Exactly. Be bold.
Absolutely.
Carpe diem.
Fish of the day?
Padumpa.
So what are some things that just to talk about some of the things that we are looking forward to in the next few days, stuff that's coming up.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I know Verlin Flieger is doing her keynote talk tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
On connections between Tolkien and the Arthurian tradition.
Yes. So that's, straight from Arthurian literature. Yes.
Excellent capstone to her Arthurian lit class at Midgard.
I'll be there.
I shall be there.
That's I'm really looking tomorrow morning, Peter Gulliver, who wrote Ring of Words.
Oh, yes.
He's doing a talk on Tolkien in the Oxford English Dictionary, and specifically he has some really interesting information about the Ainu Lindale, apparently.
Oh,
so that's at 9 a.m. tomorrow morning.
Okay, that lecture room like one, I think I've got that
one
now. Right.
Yep, lecture room one. Yeah.
Yes. And then we have John Garth is doing, he's bringing letters with him from one of the TCBS, Robert Quilt Carrie Gilson, and he's reading some of those letters, which are very, very poignant.
Is that
and
the one that we that he's done at the Festival
I
of
think
the
part
Shire?
Of it, yes.
I mean, it was a fantastic.
He will have expanded on
it. Yes, yeah, but it was fantastic.
Yeah, I missed that one. I was hanging out with his wife and toddler daughter in the back room when that was going on.
No, it was very, very good. And all he did was read these letters.
And they were just
bring
tissues. All he does is he just reads these letters, puts them into context, and you just ball. You just really do ball your eyes.
And then we
out.
Get Michael Tolkien, don't we, tomorrow?
We do.
That's right. Yes.
4 afternoon, is it?
Yes, 1:30 lunchtime. And there's a talk on the Notion Club play. Papers as well.
And on Monday, I think Dr. Dimitra Femi is doing her paper on goblins, and she's focusing on a story by Dickens, actually, which is quite interesting.
And then you're on a panel, aren't you, doing something about
on Monday? Yes, I'm chairing the panel on Monday about continuing education in Tolkien, live and online. There are a number of people who have been doing some various different things, so. and Mythgard will come up, I suspect. During that,
there's a panel on Tolkien research, which I think is going to be good.
That's opposite yours. Only because I'm resentful that I can't go, so I'm convincing
myself
that
that's... Is that opposite yours, John? It is.
With Ted Naismith,
Ted Naismith.
Yes, of course. I need a time turner.
I know.
There was just so many interesting tracks.
And there is my paper as well. On Monday.
And I think Sunday, so it is on
Sunday. Sunday morning.
Yes. Yes, I got such a shock just being asked if I could double the length of it
if you could possibly make it 4 hours long.
Just give lots of language examples.
Read
the
Quenya
lexicon.
I will do that, Andrew. I'll cue you.
Apiare. I could just do it.
I should learn from the paper today and actually make eye contact instead of just reading assiduously.
So a lot of good stuff still to come.
Brian Sibley's here. Oh, and we actually had a message from Peter Jackson himself. John Howe and Alan Lee.
They recorded a little really video nice. Message for
us.
Yeah.
Which was nice.
You mean I wasn't New Zealander enough for you?
No.
Sorry, honey.
Sorry.
And we have a wonderful French reenactment society who are camped outside, living in some
in the wind and rain.
But they're going to do reenactments of Battle of Pelennor Fields or something. I don't know. They're going to actually reenact things.
And there's lots and lots of books to buy. I think Kenny's bought most of them. Every time I see
Books.
Wonderful art display.
I've actually been thinking about Ted Naismith's paintings. I've never seen them in person before. I've only ever seen basically digital images online before. And you know, calendar images. Those are the only things I've ever actually seen.
They're stunning, aren't they?
To see them in person is really remarkable. I'm looking forward to that talk. We're basically, it's going to be a very sort of informal thing. We have about 6 to 8, depending on how many we get through. I'm going to go with probably 4 is what we'll actually get through. But anyway, and we're just going to put them up. We're going to read the passages of the text that he's drawing from and sort of think about, you know, the adaptation, you know, look at the text and look at what he's doing with the story in the particular image that he's captured. Like one of the ones, the one I'm kind of thinking of starting with is his picture of Húrin finding Morwen by the stone. Sort of reading that passage. And anyways, it's you know, because a lot of people, I think, don't really think carefully enough about the interpretive work that goes into doing a work. You know, any kind of visual image that you depict is story adaptation, and there's interpret. You know, whether you're thoughtful about it or not, and of course Teddy's very thoughtful about it. You're doing interpretation. You know, you're saying some things. You're interacting with the story in some really interesting ways. So that's basically what our talk is going to be. We're going to be kind of going through and looking at the ways in which he's using his paintings as kind of an illustration of that kind of principle, and then having him talk about, you know, his work on the painting, and I'll talk about, you know, the text and basically, I think he wants me to do most of the talking because he's sort of shy. He mentioned that he was sort of afraid that it would seem kind of like arrogant. He'd be like, "No, let us have this panel discussing, you know, the awesomeness of my paintings." He's like, "I'm afraid that's going to be awkward." And I'm like, "No, it's not going to be like that anyway." And besides, I'll do most of that. If that needs to be said, I'll say it, and then that's fine. But anyway, no, that should be fine. I've actually never met him. We've worked together several times, and had many exchanges and recorded things together with our voices. But I've never actually met him in person. So
I saw him at the talk in 2005. He gave a talk there, and he was very good indeed. Just talked his way through his paintings. He's a very quietly spoken guy. But his artwork is just stunning. That was a good convention, actually, 2005.
Birmingham. The Birmingham one,
Were you there?
I was, yes. Yeah. I think for only 2 days, though, I didn't do the whole thing.
I want to know if we're going to have a Mythgard dwarf tossing team.
Because apparently dwarf tossing is on the menu for tomorrow.
It appears to happen more than once. I don't know if they're having...
In case you missed the first dwarf tossing, there is a second opportunity.
Preliminary heats and then, you know, like a final.
I think you should make it clear these are knitted dwarfs.
Yes.
Not
actual dwarfs. No actual dwarfs will be tossed in the making of this episode. So,
no hot dwarfs.
Right, no.
No hot dwarfs. Yeah, we have to wait for those. Just
little,
a few more
little
moments.
Little
yeah.
Nitty replicas months. Of Aidan Turner for you, Sarah.
Then we might.
Deal.
Then we may even get some dwarf women.
That's Sarah's department.
Indeed.
And then we have a banquet on Sunday.
Yes.
Which
refused to bring your tux for.
I wear a tux most of my summer. I'm not wearing a tux for a banquet. No, I will. But is anyone dressing up?
Yes, I have a frock. I'm frocking.
You're frocking.
I am frocking.
Oh gosh! But you're not dressing in costume.
But not in
a hell to the no.
No. There are a number of people who are walking around wearing elven cloaks.
There really are, but I could never pass for an elf in a million years.
But that's
I'm 5 foot one, for a start. We'll just start with that. So,
okay.
But that's a question you always get when you come to these conferences and
are
people who are not in the know.
Yes.
You know, do you dress up? Do you walk around like Gandalf? You know, it's like, No.
Yes. Yes. So my answer totally depends on my mood at the moment of being asked. It really does.
Yeah. Are you bringing out your frocking is not really a verb we use in America very much.
I think I may have made it up on the spur of the moment.
Good. Sounds
that
good, though.
That might get us an R rating.
In iTunes, we have to have the explicit text.
And the non-frocking version.
The word frocking.
Coined a new word.
I did.
It'll become a hit. It'll go out there now. And
it's guaranteed to become a hit because
absolutely.
It sounds vulgar.
It does. <isn't> it? What is the past participle of the verb to frock?
Having frocked.
Having been frocked. Having been frocked. Yes. Had been.
Or you can make it a strong verb.
Yeah.
I freak.
Umlaut. Yes, exactly.
Okay, this discussion is really
it's getting into philology now.
It's too late.
Very amateur.
This is before I even mention the heels I'm wearing.
Oh, God. I'm not wearing heels.
For a change.
Oh! Get up,
okay.
Frocking in the dark.
Sorry, Dave Kemp.
Thanks for those of you who joined us live. This has been an update from the Return of the Ring conference in Loughborough, England. We may get a chance to do something later on. I'm not sure. I kind of suspect tomorrow John DiBartolo of the Middle Earth Network is arriving, so I'm suspecting a podcast is imminent after his arrival too. So that will probably happen at some point additionally this weekend. But for now, I think we will sign off. Thank you, everybody, for joining us. Thanks for those of you who have been listening in live, we will probably post this to the podcast stream fairly soon because Dave Kale isn't editing it.
Oh no!
Sorry,
Dave. Just a little benevolent dig there. I really shouldn't. That's awful. But
he's a celebrity.
He's a celebrity.
We don't hate them. The myths are fun.
Absolutely. Well, okay. So I will sign off. So, thanks for listening, and Godspeed.